Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, when parents divorce, why do their kids experience such profound emotional pain, even if those kids are already grown adults at the time of the breakup? According to Professor Andrew Root, it's because the experience strikes at the very core of a child's existence. Deep down, these big questions start to emerge. Who am I? And what is my reason for being if the two people who made me are no longer one? Andrew has written a book called The Children of Divorce. It sheds light on just what children go through during a marriage breakdown, with plenty of insights and also some guidance on how to find healing, how to bring hope out of the situation too. That's why I'm glad he's on the line. Andrew, welcome to Open House.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Your book looks at divorce from the child's perspective, just, and that could be the adult child, that could be the young child's perspective. Right from the get-go, in the intro, you say you're writing this book with fear and trembling, because the very talk about divorce, of course, for so many people, is such a pain-filled topic for them that they say, okay, where are you going to go with this? Are you going to be heaping guilt on me or whatever? I mean, that's something that you're very, very quick, right at the beginning of the book, to distill.
Yeah, I mean, I really did write the book in fear and trembling, because I think the last thing that I want to do is heap any guilt on people. I mean, I think that divorce is always painful, whether you're the one going through divorce or whether you're a child of divorce. But I felt compelled to write it simply to kind of articulate my own experience. And I do think, at least in the American context, that we haven't quite dealt with divorce from the child's perspective and really took into consideration maybe what's going on inside the life of the child as divorce happens. But again, in my own context, always conversations about family and divorce have, I think, been too politically polarizing and either very hurtful to people or what have you. And so I'm very aware that I don't want to do that. But at the same time, I do think a story about divorce hasn't quite been told.
Yes. Let's talk about your story then, because not only are you an academic in this field, you've researched it, but you are also the adult child of divorce, and in fact also your wife is. In fact, it was actually while you and your wife-to-be, your fiancé at the time, were going out and about to basically get ready to get married that both of you experienced your parents' divorce.
Yeah, that's right. We, my wife and I, well, my girlfriend at the time, and I got engaged right before Christmas. And we were living in Los Angeles at the time and had flown back to Minneapolis and where my parents lived and her parents lived, got engaged, flew back, went back to school. We were both graduate students at the time. And within 3 months, I received a phone call from her one night, and she was in utter tears and went over to her apartment, and she told me that her mom had just called and that her parents' marriage of 25-plus years was falling apart. So here we were, less than 8 weeks into our engagement, and all of a sudden her parents' marriage was falling apart.
Now, just describe what she said as a result of that, because it's really quite telling to this whole whole topic.
Yeah, you know, I remember her rolled up in a ball on her bed and telling me this, and then sitting up and just saying, "I have to start all over again. I don't even know who I am in the midst of this." And for my wife, her family had been, you know, church going folks their whole life, and she was under the impression that everything was going pretty well. I mean, she knew that there was some conflict, but for the most part, she thought that they had a pretty solid marriage. And her father actually was her hero, and now this was all falling apart, and there were certain stories told of indiscretions and things like that, and her response was just, I have to start all over again. And so for the next few months, to watch her really deal with these questions were intense. And then we were both training to be pastors at the time, and we were living in seminary housing, and in the middle of the night she would often call me, and she would just call me frightened and scared. Mm-hmm. And she had no really rational reason to be scared. She just felt this overwhelming fear come over her. I mean, there's no fear that there was a burglar at her door or anything even supernatural. She just simply felt utter fear, the fear of her being. She would often come over to my apartment in the middle of the night and sleep on the floor or sleep on the couch. She was just utterly afraid. Mm-hmm. And the only way I could articulate it was the fear of her being, that she had to start all over again, and she wondered who she was now that these people that were responsible for her being in the world were kind of falling apart.
Yeah.
But the story gets even more complicated, because by May of that year, so now within 5 months of our engagement, my father called and informed me that my parents' marriage was falling apart. So now my fiancé's questions really became my own, and there was just this overwhelming shock of who am I and what, how do I exist in the world now that these people are falling, their marriage is falling apart. And the only way I can really describe it, both for myself and for my fiancé, now wife at the time, was that I call it the Back to the Future effect. And I don't know if people in Australia remember the great 1984 American movie Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox. Well, there's a scene about towards the end of the movie where Michael J. Fox goes back in time to 1954, and the whole point is he has to get his parents together to fall in love again now that they're in high school, or he won't exist. And at one point in the movie, it looks like it's not going to happen, and his parents may fall in love with other people, and he looks at his own hand, and it becomes translucent. It's like he's disappearing from existence. And it's the only way I can really explain the experience of divorce for myself and for my wife, and then doing this research, that for young people, divorce has this effect of thrusting our being into question. We feel like the Back to the Future, like we're disappearing from existence, because after all, we're only in the world because these two people have come together and formed some bond, and now that they're falling apart, we wonder who are we and how do we exist at all. So the book really tries to define divorce and examine it as what I call an ontological issue, or an issue of being.
Open House is what you're listening to. Andrew Root is an academic. He's a professor. He's an author of this book, The Children of Divorce. We're talking about that, the effects of divorce on a child. And we're not necessarily talking about young children. We're talking about adult children as well. Just what it actually does to a person's being. 1-300-40-2020 is my number if you'd like to throw something into the conversation. Maybe your experience matches what Andrew has just described of his own experience of his parents' divorce and also his now wife's parents' divorce. Let's explore that a little bit further then. There's this question about my identity. Who am I? How do I exist when the two people who came together and produced me are no longer together themselves? What is going on there then, psychologically and also, you know, theologically?
Yeah. In the book, I try to draw from actually the great 20th century German philosopher Martin Heidegger. And of course, Heidegger's work really tried to articulate how we have our being, how we exist in the world. And one of the most interesting things, of course, if anyone's read him, you know it's opaque and it's always difficult to read Heidegger. But really, it's very practical in what he's trying to articulate, and so practical that he says that we actually have our being around our practical ways of acting, that we actually have our being in the practical ways that we live our lives out. And I think one of the things that happens in divorce is that we, at least in my own country, we've tried to frame it as really an issue of knowledge and then an issue of structure. And what I mean by that is we want kids to know that divorce is not their fault, that parents are separating and it's not the child's fault that they're divorcing. And then we need to make sure that there's government or just school structures in place and laws in place to make sure, for instance, that children are cared for and they don't fall into poverty, or there's after-school programs or things like that. Mm. And I actually think those are really important issues, and I'm not trying to minimize those at all. But really, I think for children, the issue is, how do I exist at all, and do I exist at all now that these people are no longer together? And how do I act? How do I even act in the world now that they're no longer together? And I think that always happens, whether your parents divorce when you're 14 or 24, that everything changes now. And holidays and Christmas are different. Even how we talk to our parents changes. And that doesn't even end. I mean, my parents have been divorced over 10 years now, and we still deal with this. You know, do we tell one parent that the other parent got our son this gift for Christmas, or do we not say that because we're afraid of hurting their feelings? Mm. So our ontology is really based in, our being is really based in how we act in the world. And when that changes, it forces us, our very being in the world, to change. And so I think divorce has this way, very practically, of forcing us into questioning who we are.
Mm. There's this lovely Latin phrase called the Imago Dei. Now, of course, it goes back to the book of Genesis and how humans are said to have been built, made, created, shaped, crafted in the image of God, the Imago Dei in the Latin. This comes into the conversation. It's quite important as to how we understand what that image of God actually is too.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that we've, I think, too often seen the Imago Dei, this image of God, the image of God in us, as a substance, kind of like the juicy center of a piece of gum or something like that. That it's this substance we have in us, and it's actually, I think, used, that theological doctrine has been used detrimentally within the history of theology, and particularly more recent theology. So we say that just as God is all powerful and has dominion, so we have that substance of God in us, and it's actually justified oppressive actions that I think the church has taken. But ultimately, it sees what it means to be made in the image of God as having this substance. So it's to be able to have power or have intellect or have a certain kind of emotions. And I think too often, to kind of translate that into the divorce conversation, that when we've seen what it means to be human and what it means to be made in the image of God as this substance, then when we go on to interpret young people's experience of divorce, we tend to think, well, their substance seems okay. I mean, their grades are fine. Their emotions seem in check. They seem like their substance is okay, and we think that therefore there isn't a problem. Yeah. But recently, and by recently I mean maybe in the last 30 or 40 years, there started to be this groundswell of interpreting the Imago Dei, the image of God, not as a substance but as a relationship. So as it says in the book of Genesis, that we created them in the image of God, male and female, we created them in the image of God. And it seems like some theologians have interpreted that at the core of what it means to be made in the image of God is to be in relationship with others, mm-hmm. with neighbor, with other human beings, as well as to be in relationship with God. So I try to translate this into the divorce conversation and say, well, maybe the issue of divorce isn't about corrupting a young person's substance, but actually is about breaking the core relationship that makes them human. Okay. As the Christian tradition has tended to say, that we are human in our relationships and in relationships of being with and for each other, so we have our humanity. And then divorce becomes this issue of our most primary community, again, the community that gives us being split and being put asunder, and that I think shakes the image of God in us. It feels tragic, and we have to deal with this tragic, even existential reality because of it.
So our being is based on, number one, how we live our lives and the relationships that we actually have in everyday life, and number two, if the Bible is correct, and you and I would both suggest that it is, that we're actually made in the image of a relational God, built to have relationship. We are formed from relationship, and so then that's why divorce cuts us so deeply. I guess it cuts across the grain of both of those approaches.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Open House is what you're listening to. 1-300-40-2020. It's a sensitive subject, isn't it? We're talking about divorce and the impact of divorce on children. We're not here to heap any guilt. We're not talking about the causes, not talking about the rights and the wrongs of divorce. We're just talking about the fact that children of divorce, adult children of divorce, actually wrestle when their parents divorce. And what Andrew Root is saying, it messes with our fundamental being. It challenges who we are at the very core of our very selves. He's the author of The Children of Divorce. All right, I just want to unpack a little bit more before we start to get to some hope. Just unpack a little bit more then how this works out in everyday life. And in fact, maybe if you want to, how much it's worked out in your and your now wife's life living as an adult child of a divorced couple.
Yeah, I mean, I think the hardest thing is it always kind of thrusts conflict and division within us. I mean, both of us love deeply both of our parents and don't want to do anything that would hurt them, and we always feel stuck between their two worlds. There's actually a really wonderful book written in the United States by a friend of mine, Elizabeth Marquardt, who wrote this book called Between Two Worlds, The Children of Divorce. And her argument essentially is what I'm trying to get at philosophically and theologically, which is that once divorce happens, it thrusts children really practically to actually live in two worlds. Hmm. That what marriage does at its most simplistic is bring two distinct individuals' lives into one world. I mean, that's kind of the point of marriage, is that you live together, you're two different people, but you bring your worlds together and form one world, and then the child is born into that one world. But essentially what divorce does is it says that one world is impossible, and so the two parents split up, and now it becomes the child's job to do what was supposed to be the responsibility of the parents. And now the child has to actually live between these two worlds and to figure figure this out. We're going through in our own family that my wife's father is now getting remarried, and he'll get remarried this summer or sometime soon. Mm. And when this happened, the only thing that, you know, and this has been 10 years since the divorce has occurred, so this wasn't out of nowhere. And you know how families go. My wife Cara had actually already received word that this was going to happen, and so she finally had this conversation with her dad, and her dad told her that she was going to get remarried, and she said she felt so silly because she found herself all of a sudden crying. Mm-hmm. And she started crying when she asked her dad what he would do with his house. And when he said that he may sell it or he's not sure what to do, she found herself crying. And I think that it goes back to that ontological conversation, is that that we have our being around things like houses and like rooms, and when those have to actually be moved, we feel that really shakes our being. And so she was upset about this, and she ended up at work, and she was kind of still upset. And some of her coworkers said, "Well, what's wrong?" And she said, "Well, my dad's getting remarried." And she said, "Well, the coworker said, "Well, do you not like the woman he's marrying?" And her response was, "No, the woman's great, and she's probably more than my dad deserves." But nevertheless, this still hurts so deeply. And so I think that that's the kind of division that we're thrust into, that we can feel very happy for a parent that they're getting remarried, but it still feels like to us it's not supposed to necessarily be this way, or it thrusts us into contradiction in a certain way to see our parent have to actually be remarried. And even though we can rationally and say, well, this is good for my dad and I'm really happy for my dad, and this is, and she's even better than my dad deserves, at the ontological level we feel this overwhelming burden, like we feel stuck, and this still isn't my mom, and I don't know what to do with that.
Mm. All right, I wanted to get you to just comment on a couple of different scenarios then. One is just what people can now do to help young people that are suffering through divorce, and then I want to get to this whole issue of identity, particularly, say, for the adult child of divorce, but firstly the child. So we've already got, say, a situation where a marriage is dissolved to the point where it's just irreconcilable. There's going to be some washout in terms of the children, that's for sure. Now, what can people around them do to help ease that suffering for those children?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing, and it seems really simple, but it rarely happens. And the first thing I think we need to do for children, especially those who aren't adults yet, is allow something, and I think this is true with children who are adults as well, is allow something to be two things at once. And what I mean by that is, so often I think children of divorce, their perspective and their narrative on the experience has not been allowed to be shared, because they feel like, well, if I really say how deeply this hurts or the deep questions I have, then I'm going to hurt mom, and mom's already hurt enough as it is.
Okay, well, that would be a very common comment, wouldn't it? Mom's already hurt as much, dad's already hurting. That the last thing they want is for me to come and dump my stuff on them.
Exactly, yeah. And so, and I think it often happens, what will happen is a young person will try out the narrative and say how disappointed they are, and they'll get a response from mom or dad that says, well, you don't really understand, or come on, you know what you're saying is really hurting me right now. And then they feel like all of a sudden they can't say anything, and they have no place to articulate how much this hurts. So I wonder if we imagined and were willing to allow an event like a divorce to be two things at once. And so for parents, it could be a certain form of liberation, or it could be something that didn't have any other possibility but to end this way. But that, just because that might be true, and I think I want to say that could very well be true, doesn't mean for your child that it isn't still a deeply painful thing.
Mm.
So the question is, how do you allow your child to articulate that without it feeling like it shakes your ontological core as well? I mean, this is things we deal with in our family all the time is, you know, whenever I express my experience to my mother, she always feels defensive about it, and yet I don't feel like I have anywhere where I can really share my own experience of this, and I don't mean to judge her or judge anyone. I think that young people who experience divorce simply want to be able to articulate their experience. So how parents could allow that to happen, I think, would be very powerful.
Yes, okay. Then this whole sense of identity, how do you rebuild that?
Yeah, and, you know, part of me wishes that I had a 10-step program that I was selling as a curriculum that goes along with this.
You'd make a lot of money, wouldn't you?
Right, and community organizations could use. But actually, my argument in the book is both, I think, simple and, dare I say, kind of profound in a certain way. And what I mean by that is that I actually think what children of divorce need is not a program, and but is actually a community to belong in. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of my pitch for the church to actually be what the church is supposed to be, and the church to be this community where we actually have our being, mm-hmm. and our being as we can confess the love of God, and this being that hears each other's story and recognizes that we're mutually broken people. And I think if we have our identity in a community, if we have our being that comes out of community, like we talked about the Imago Dei, if who we are at our core is relational, communal beings, then our identity is always formed and upheld in community. And I think what children and all children of divorce need is a community actually to belong in, mm-hmm. a community that says, we know who you are, you belong here, in a community that we can act in and be in. And so it seems almost simplistic for how dramatic in some ways that I've articulated the problem, but if anyone who's experienced real community of being seen, of being known, of taking on the rituals of the community, you know it has a way of ontologically holding you secure.
Yeah, one of the most transformative things in my life is a little group of friends who I get together with every Friday night, and we eat together, and we pray together, we read the Bible together, we share life together, we pray for each other. And we've all gone through some pretty rough stuff, and yet that little community is just so important. You also touch on routines. What role does routine have in this?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I think routines are really powerful, and one of the most painful things about divorce is that for sure, immediately, it throws all routine up in the air. So just really simple routines like noticing your father's dirty socks on the floor, or the smell of your mother's cologne or perfume, that all of those things change. And then more radically, holidays and after school and all those things really change. And I think that what children of divorce often need is a community to belong in that has some practices and some routines that they can really cling to in the midst of this experience, that becomes, I think, a really important thing for them.
We've talked about the value of community. What else can a friend do, or friends, plural, can actually do to help a person who's the child of divorce, maybe an adult child, maybe a young child?
Yeah, two things is I think one, at least in my own cultural context in the States, I worry that divorce and the experience of divorce has become a lot like violence on TV, where we see it so much that we become kind of sensitized to it. And so often I even think in the context of a church that, you know, on the ride home, a couple will say to themselves, oh, poor Jessica, her parents are being divorced. It must be so hard for her. But no one ever says anything to her. And we worry that if we say something to her that we become rigid and maybe feel judgmental towards her parents or something like that. But the first thing I think we can really actually do is just simply communicate to young people that this must be a hard situation. And no matter how you feel, I don't think that determines that you need to make a judgment call on whether the parents ever should have divorced or even what God thinks about divorce, but to simply know that this has got to be a traumatic time for you. And I think too often we don't even articulate that much to young people, that we just kind of behind the scenes think, wow, this must be hard for them, but never even with one or two sentences say, you know, this must be hard. I'm sure your mind is really spinning and this will make your head spin right now. So I think that's one thing, is simply letting young people know that they're not alone in this and that someone actually sees that this must be difficult. I think when you're drowning in the situation, that just feels like a life preserver, that someone in the world understands that this is difficult. The second thing that I think can be done by a family member, say a grandma or grandpa or just someone close to the young person, and this rarely happens and it seems counterintuitive to us, but I think that young people need to hear stories about their parent when their parents actually were together.
Because that would be counterintuitive. There'd almost be that sense of inevitable grief. Oh, that's what they were like. Isn't it a shame they're not?
Yeah, and I think that we could see that if we think that what could happen is if they had too much information about this, it would corrupt their substance. But I think what we need is to find ways of knitting together our narrative and even our biographical narrative that stretches all the way back to our origins.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for children whose parents go through a divorce when they're, say, 2 or 3, and they don't have much recollection of their parents together, or it just seems like there's so much strife and so much distance that they can't even remember what it was like to see their mom embrace their dad, and no one ever talks about it. And I think that it seems counterintuitive, but I think it becomes helpful to children of divorce to hear about their parents' courtship,
right,
and to hear that there was a time that they actually really did love each other,
so
or
you
didn't care about each other.
You really were a product of love.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you were really, and I think we often go to the other extreme where we never talk about it, and I think it makes young people feel like, well, where do I belong, and how did I find myself in the world? And just simply retelling those stories, we risk that we feel like, oh, are we going to hurt somebody's feelings, or are we going to bring up old wounds or something? But I think because I define the issue so much as an ontological issue, I think retelling those stories is a way to give them ontological security more than it is to kind of thrust them into any more anxiety. I think it actually becomes really generative and important.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. All right, now you've talked about the importance of the Christian church. What one thing could the church do then, once a person actually arrives at the church, to actually help somebody who is a child of divorce navigate their way through?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that has to happen is that that churches need to find rhetorical ways of speaking about divorce and the pain that it thrusts on children without it becoming a judgmental stick to beat parents with. And I think that's one of the reasons we're so afraid to talk about it, actually, is that we just feel like, well, we don't want to be judgmental or fundamentalistic about it. And, in my own school, we've had some conversations about this, and a number of local pastors have said, you know, I told some people at my church that I was going to come to this conversation on children of divorce, and I could feel how tense they were.
Hmm.
I could feel that they were worried about me going and having this conversation. And, of course, for people who have actually gone through divorce, they know it's an incredibly painful thing, but I just worry that if we don't find ways to actually face it and talk about it, that we leave a large amount of the population without any place to talk about it. And at least some studies done in the United States have shown that children of divorce, they don't go to church at all.
Mm.
That the number of children of divorce, that it's a much lower that they would ever attend church than children who haven't experienced divorce. And I think part of that reason is a deeper theological reason, and that's that the church hasn't done a very good job of talking about these deep questions of suffering and of wrestling and of struggle. That hasn't been, at least in my cultural context, something the church has been about. We've been much more about kind of this happy, positive Christianity, and I think that young people who have experienced divorce then feel like the church is not a very viable place for them to go and participate because they have these really deep, significant questions.
Mm.
And what's most interesting is that some other studies have shown that on self-report, children of divorce rate themselves very highly in the area of spirituality, which I think that this experience of divorce makes them deep thinkers, that wrestling with these ontological questions gives them really deep questions. But what's ironic is they don't feel like a Christian community is somewhere to deal with those deep, longing, dark, even questions. So I think the church actually needs to become a braver place that's willing to call a thing what it is. And there's a rich Christian tradition of things being paradoxical and things being two things at once, like the very humanity and divinity of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And we haven't done a very good job at that.
Yeah. When the Bible talks about God hating divorce, you understand now, after what we've talked about, just why. I mean, it actually puts it into context, doesn't it? I mean, this is why. I mean, people are actually destroyed through divorce. As people who have divorced know, it's destroyed their own lives, often for very important reasons. They've had to move. There's been abuse, whatever it might have been. There might be very, very significant reasons why the marriage had to dissolve, but you can understand why God says he hates divorce.
Yeah, and the way I would add to that is I think God hates divorce, but I think God hates divorce because God hates broken community. I mean,
yes.
I think, and what I mean by that, I mean, I think hate almost sounds too moralistic,
yeah.
And I think the way I'd rather package that theologically, and I think it's more legitimate theologically, is that the work of God, the action of God in the world, is always to take what's broken and can and take what's broken into God's self and bring life out of it. And so God hates when any community is broken, because I think it's so primary to us. But the God of the cross and the God of the resurrection is always one that embraces those who are broken, broken by community or break community, and offers them life out of death. And I think that's the good news for both people who have experienced divorce and the children who have had that experience thrust upon them, is that the God of Jesus Christ is a God that doesn't necessarily work in moralistic categories, but works in categories of life and death, and is always found where death is operative, seeking to break its hold to bring forth life.
Nicely put. Good to talk to you, Andrew. Thanks for joining us on the Open House to talk about what is a very important topic.
Thanks for having me, and it's great to at least be heard in Australia.
Well, I think quite a few people were listening intently. Andrew Root there, he's an assistant professor of youth and family ministry at Luther Seminary in the US, and author of this book, The Children of Divorce.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.